Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The situation in Somalia is dire to the point of nightmarish, spawned by the worst drought in 60 years and coupled with 2 decades of civil war launched by Islamic insurgents. The UN has now officially declared famine. Why has this situation, called a human tragedy of unimaginable proportions, been created, and how might it improve? Aid workers predicted it, and now upwards of 10 million people are vulnerable across the region. This hour, On Point, the famine in Somalia, the spreading catastrophe in East Africa, and our global response, or lack of it. You can join the conversation. Are you paying attention to Somalia? Our global leaders? What kind of action do you want and expect the world to take? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Mogadishu is Jeffrey Gettleman. He's the East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and he's closely watching events unfold. Welcome to the show, Jeff Gettleman.
I'm glad to help.
You have been to Somalia, I understand, over a dozen times in recent years. Why don't you bring us up to date on exactly what is happening as tens of thousands of refugees flee the starvation zones?
Well, I've never really seen anything that approaches how desperate and depressing and upsetting the situation is. I've spent the last couple of days going around Mogadishu talking to people who have arrived from these drought-stricken areas in the rural parts of Somalia. And they have come here for help, for food, for water, for medical care, and there just really isn't that much help available. I just came from a hospital about an hour ago where a 2-year-old girl died right in front of us, and the father wrapped her up in a blue blanket, picked up the body, and started walking out of the hospital door and said he didn't have any money for transportation to go bury her. And his family was following behind him, and his other 2 children were incredibly malnourished, walking on really thin chopstick-like legs. And the city is full of people like this. They are people who have been totally wiped out by the drought. They've lost their animals, their livelihood. They've sold their farms to get just a little money to get here. And the government here is trying to cope with this, but the needs are just overwhelming.
Jeffrey, would you please sketch out for us a little bit the history here? For 20 years, there has been civil war in Somalia. It's not the first time that there's been a famine in the country. And workers had predicted this. It's known that there were weather forecasts that said that rainfall was going to be slight. How come things got so badly relatively quickly?
That's a really good question. Somalia has been in a state of chaos since 1991, when the central government collapsed, clan militias fought for control of the country, and nobody won. And as a result, there has been no functioning central government for 20 years. There have been various attempts by the United Nations and donor countries to support a transitional government, and none have succeeded. And the situation we have today is that there's a weak transitional government in the center of Mogadishu, the capital, but large swathes of the country are controlled by Islamic insurgents. This is relatively new. It started in about 2005, 2006. You had an Islamic movement that began to take power across the country. They briefly ruled Somalia. Then they were pushed out by Ethiopia. And ever since then, you've just had this kind of, you know, low-level civil war. We're not talking about big battles with tanks or a lot of people killed, but just constant hit-and-run attacks, suicide bombs, and an insurgency that won't quit. And that has left the country compromised, and it's made it very dangerous for aid workers to get in here. And that's what we're looking at. There's a drought right now across the entire Horn of Africa, which includes Ethiopia, Eritrea, Djibouti, Kenya, Somalia, parts of Uganda, Sudan. But the only places there's a famine are in Somalia because aid workers cannot deliver food here.
Mm-hmm. And we might point out that Foreign Policy's Index of Failed States places Somalia this year at the top. Somalia ranks number one. You can check that out on our website, by the way, at onpointradio.org. So describe what it is that has changed then in Mogadishu. It sounds like thousands of people coming in.
Well, a couple things are changing. It's slightly ironic that the government now is doing better than it has for years. There are street lights that are working. There's garbage pickups. There are programs in place to manage taxes and to pay government soldiers. All of this is the sort of basics of running a country or administration, but it had been absent from Somalia for years. But at the same time, outside of Mogadishu, you have this crippling drought, and anybody who can leave these desiccated rural areas is doing that. And they're selling their things and buying tickets for buses or for trucks to get here. And when they arrive, they have absolutely nothing. And the displaced people are inhabiting, you know, this ruined landscape of Mogadishu that has not really been rebuilt from the Civil War. So you see people in these tiny little tents and domes-shaped huts that they built out of sticks, camped out next to bullet-pock buildings, you know, in the middle of an urban area, next to old Italian villas, and there's thousands of them, tens of thousands of them. And the government is trying to get the resources to feed the people and to help treat them medically, but the aid community is very skittish about coming into Somalia. And I should say there are a few aid groups that work here, mm-hmm. but not many. And that's why there's the big problem.
Well, skittish because there have been attacks on them, and I believe people have been killed in the past. Do you know which groups are working there now?
Yeah, so there's a couple UN agencies that still work in Somalia, including in the Shabaab-controlled areas, the areas controlled by the militants. UNICEF is one of them. The World Health Organization still has a few programs, but they don't have many international staff. They don't have a lot of technical capacity. And we see that. I mean, it sounds abstract, but I was just at this hospital, and these children are brought in there who are totally malnourished, emaciated. You know, they look like tiny little skeletons that are still breathing, and there's no doctors there to treat them. So you can't just spoon them food. They're too far gone for mm-hmm. that. They need IVs. They need special diets to survive, and there just aren't people like that in Mogadishu to help them.
You know, as horrible as the situation is today, and it has been precarious politically and in terms of violence for many years, you wrote, I thought, what was a very affecting piece in Foreign Policy magazine a couple of years ago about your affection for this place. And sometimes I think when these horrible calamities are happening, Haiti or other such places that are often at risk, it's instructive to remember why correspondents like you develop the affection that you do.
Well, Somalia is one of the biggest stories in this part of Africa where I work, and I feel very committed to it. And I've met, you know, so many dedicated, wonderful people who have shown me a different side of this place and who are incredibly generous and hospitable and funny. And it's kind of an adventure to work in a place like this. And I've done stories on pirates, I've done stories about Islamic militants, I've done stories about the government trying to take back control of the country, I've done stories about Somali journalists risking their lives to do broadcasts, but, you know, it's hard to overcome a kind of sense of hopelessness at this moment, because there are so many people on the brink. And there just is, you know, help is on its way, but not in the way that is going to make a difference for a lot of people. I mean, yes, lives will be saved and hopefully a lot of deaths will be prevented, but there's so many people right now in the city where I am who are going to perish from this famine before anybody helps them.
Do you feel that your best efforts as a journalist have somehow not been sufficient here?
You know, yes and no. I mean, I feel like I've done as much as I can to shine a spotlight on this place in so many different ways, by writing about it in the New York Times, by doing pieces like the foreign policy piece you mentioned, by risking my own life to come here and to, you know, chronicle what's happening and to analyze it. So I think I've contributed to getting more people aware, making more people aware of Somalia. But, you know, there's a fatigue here. People are very discouraged by a place like Somalia, and for good reason, because it's been sort of stuck in this rut. So if I do more stories about this desperate situation, a lot of people aren't going to be surprised and therefore aren't going to be that moved.
We just have a minute and a half in this part of the show. I'm just wondering, people are going to be saying, what can I do? And that is something we're going to be exploring through the hour. What do you think, Jeffrey?
Well, they need, you know, these aid organizations need money. And if people are interested in helping, that is one way to do it. Because, you know, aid is expensive, especially in Somalia. They have to pay for food. They have to pay for transport. They have to ship the aid in from overseas. They hire staff to help distribute it. So the easiest way to help is to, you know, get on the web and look at which big aid organizations are working in Somalia. And there's a bunch, Oxfam, CARE, Save the Children, others, and UN agencies like the World Food Program, and figure out a way to contribute to those.
Well, thank you so much for your efforts and your reporting and for being with us today. Jeffrey Gettleman, East Africa Bureau Chief for The New York Times. I'm Jackie Leiden. I'm in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the famine facing millions of people in Somalia and the food crisis across the East Africa region. Joining me now is Sinead Murray. She's an aid worker with the International Rescue Committee and working in one of the refugee camps in a town called Dadaab on the border of Somalia and Kenya. Welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Sinead Murray, why don't you just tell us what you've been doing lately and what you've seen today?
Well, basically, within we work in one of the camps in Dadaab called Hagadera, and IRC provide both the medical services as well as supporting the gender-based violence program here. We continue to see more and more new arrivals flooding across the border on a daily basis. I think current estimates are that more than 60,000 have arrived in Dadaab since the beginning of June. And these are coming in a very bad state. Many of them are women and girls. And when they reach Hagadera, they often have walked for quite a long time, some up to 20 days. They haven't had food, water. And there's also a high likelihood that many of the women and girls may have experienced violence on the way.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you oversee a program aimed at improving the lot of these women and protecting them. What is it that you can do for them?
At the moment, we have staff based in the reception centers where the new arrivals are received. And we try and identify survivors of sexual assault from the new arrivals and confidentially refer them to immediate medical care and ensure that they access appropriate counseling. A lot of what we're doing is just providing information on the available services. Since June, we have seen a fourfold increase in reporting of sexual violence. Last week and this week, we've also noticed spikes. Many of them are the women and girls coming across the border. But many of these are not coming forward to report because of a lot of shame and stigma associated with sexual violence. And we're really scaling up our response services to better target them to ensure that they can come forward and access the services.
Sinead, you are there. Could you just describe what this camp looks like? I know that it is holding vastly more people than it is supposed to. Give us a really good picture, would you please?
Sure, Jackie. It is literally bursting at the seams. Even before the influx, it was stretched to capacity. It's only supposed to house 30,000. We currently have upwards from 130,000 just in this camp alone. Many of the new arrivals, they can't find anywhere to live in the existing camp. So on the outskirts, you just see lots and lots of tents scattered around. many of them don't even have tents, so they're living in little tukus, which are made out of wood and covered with sheets.
Mm-hmm.
It is every day I go out, and I go to the same areas, and sometimes I don't recognize them because they're changing so rapidly.
You know, sometimes a picture or a portrait of something like famine is overwhelming, and sometimes it'll seem to be crystallized or elucidated by a single image. And we were looking at a photo earlier that I believe you're familiar with, and this is a photo of a child at one of the International Rescue Committee's field hospitals in Dadaab, a seven-month-old child. He's being referred to by the Associated Press as the frail face of famine in the Horn of Africa. This little baby weighs only about half of what he's supposed to. What else can you tell me about this baby?
Well, I was just speaking to some health colleagues there, and apparently Mihad is starting to breastfeed, and he is showing signs of improvement. I think over the night, his weight dropped a little bit because of diarrhea, but he's on the mend, and the doctors are confident that he will make a recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But he is just... He may be the face of the famine, but he's just one of countless children here that are severely malnourished.
Right.
And really need
immediate
assistance.
That. But you gave us an opportunity, thank you, to put name and face and situation together, and that too can be found on our website. I'd like to bring some other voices into the conversation. Joining me from Washington are two people who are following the situation very closely, and both have been there recently. Semhar Araya is the Horn of Africa Regional Policy Advisor for Oxfam America. She just returned from a two-month trip to Kenya. Hello, Semhar.
Hello. How are you, Jackie?
Fine. Thank you for joining us. And E.J. Hogendorn is Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. Welcome, E.J.
Thank you.
Why don't you both tell us what you have learned as you follow this professionally? Semhar, let's begin with you, because I think you only came back a week or so ago, right?
Yeah, that's right. I just returned from Kenya and was there just as the impact of the drought was revealing itself.
And, of course, Kenya is where people are fleeing.
That's right. We're seeing massive needs on the ground, as Jeff and Sinead have mentioned. There's 12 million people throughout the region who are in need of life-saving assistance because of the drought. But also in south-central Somalia, the effects of what is now a famine are driving people out in droves. And in Dadaab and in southeastern Ethiopia, in the camp of Dolo Odo, we're seeing needs at unprecedented levels. Currently, about 9,000 people a week are arriving in Dadaab alone. 2,000 are arriving in Dolo Odo in Ethiopia. And so there's a need and an urgent appeal for funding and donations so that we can provide life-saving assistance. Oxfam works in Kenya and Ethiopia, and we work through partners in Somalia. We're not inside Somalia, but we work through Somali aid organizations that have been there for years. Oxfam has been with these partners for over 40 years. We have extensive experience in Somalia working with partners and communities. So what we're seeing is a massive scaling up that's needed and a global response. And in terms of Somali reactions and the needs, what's fascinating about this is, as devastating as the crisis is, we've seen a stepping up of sorts on the ground in different communities, and ultimately it is about their capacity and the resources. Somalis, Kenyans, Ethiopians, people of this region, they are resilient. These are reoccurring droughts that the region has seen for years. And this famine is taking place for a multitude of reasons. And because of the lack of rains over the last 2 years, because of the protracted conflict in parts of the Horn, and also the lack of long-term investment in East Africa and the lack of long-term economic development assistance, we're seeing a constant cycle of humanitarian emergencies. But what we're seeing today is really grave and profound.
Mm-hmm. E.J. Hogendorn, does that give us something like fatigue? I mean, when you have the UN saying, look, this region meets famine statistics, and I believe that's over 30% of children malnourished, two deaths per 10,000 amongst adults, people unable to get food, unable to get basic needs. There had been predictions that this could happen. And it's happening. So how do you square that with what you know, the fact that despite reports, it's occurring?
Well, I think there are two issues. One is that there has essentially been a chronic emergency in Somalia for the last 20 years. And in that respect, there certainly is fatigue about providing assistance to a place where things don't seem to be improving. The other thing, though, that's compounding the problems and is making the provision of a humanitarian assistance much more complicated is the fact that Al-Shabaab, which is a designated terrorist organization, controls much of southern Somalia.
And this is a group with links to Al-Qaeda, right?
Correct. It's a group that does have some links to Al-Qaeda. And as I mentioned, it's a designated terrorist organization. That implies that it has legal restrictions imposed on it by the United States and some other governments, too. And so humanitarian agencies are very reticent about operating in those areas because if any of that aid goes to Shabaab, they are technically in violation of U.S. and other countries' laws.
So that really complicates efforts to get food and supplies, medical supplies and basic humanitarian aid into the camps where it's most needed, correct?
Correct. We are arguing that one of the things the United States should certainly consider is a temporary lifting of these restrictions in an effort to allow humanitarian agencies to provide food much closer to these malnourished populations. As we heard from Jeffrey Gettleman, part of the problem is that many of these people have to travel enormous distances to get to camps where food is available. Those camps are now outside of areas controlled by Al-Shabaab, but many aid agencies, you know, think that they can provide those services much closer to the locations where the famines have been declared.
Mm-hmm. And is that, are you talking with the law, I think it's called Office of Foreign Assets and Control, that says we cannot give aid to organizations that might funnel that aid to terrorist organizations, to terrorists?
Correct. And what that really means is that there's a dilemma. The United States recently announced that they are now actually willing to operate in southern Somalia, provided that they have assurances that aid will not be diverted to Al-Shabaab.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, when you operate in an extremely complex humanitarian emergency like that, it's almost impossible to ensure that that aid will not be diverted, or at least some of that aid will not be diverted. And so a lot of humanitarian agencies risk, by going into Shabaab-controlled areas, inadvertently supporting Al-Shabaab groups. And that, of course, would put them in legal jeopardy vis-a-vis the Office of Foreign Asset Controls or other organizations that are concerned about aid benefiting Al-Shabaab.
Mm-hmm. Sinead, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I guess the one thing we would argue is that irrespective of the fact that some aid may trickle down to Al-Shabaab, we would argue that the humanitarian need far outweighs the marginal benefit that Al-Shabaab would accrue from that, and that this is also an important opportunity for the United States and other Western donors to demonstrate that they are actually much more interested in helping Somalis than they are in just prosecuting the war on terror. And it would be an important a signal that the United States cares a great deal about the Somali people and Muslims in general.
I wanted to ask about the people and bring it back to Sinead Murray. Sinead, what kinds of people and what kinds of human stories are you hearing about people who you mentioned one woman who'd walked for several weeks. What are you hearing about their life stories?
Well, within our program, and it is very focused on the violence they're experiencing. Like, some of the women and girls are being attacked on the route from Somalia to Kenya. They've said that they've been taken, that things are taken from them, they're raped, and we've had some reports of women coming to the camp naked.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen, have many of them told you that they have had to leave behind children, that children have died along the way?
We do. We have heard that quite often. And I think it's been quite well documented that because of the distance, the lack of food, the lack of water already, when they were leaving Somalia, they're already fleeing from quite a protracted drought. Their food sources have kind of dried up quite a while ago. So this journey is their last resort, and so many are dying along the way.
Let's take a call here. Vincent is calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hello, Vincent. You're with On Point.
Yes, hello, Jackie, and your two guests. How are you?
We're fine, thanks.
Yes, I am a citizen of Uganda, and I just had an inquiry. I know the AU and
the African Union.
The African Union, with some East African countries, Uganda, maybe Rwanda, and others, they have forces, military forces up there in Somalia. And I'm inquiring why they cannot provide some security to these agencies that are trying to distribute food and all the necessities that are needed desperately by the people in Somalia.
All right.
I know these forces are being funded by donor countries. I'm not really sure if the United States is one of the countries that funds these forces. We want to know to what extent can they help in this situation. Are they just using, the parts that they get and they don't do the work that they're supposed to do? What's going on? Maybe your guests may have some ideas and comments on this issue.
Okay, thank you, Vincent. What about that, E.J. Hagendorf? And the African Union has been involved in Somalia before. What about, what can it do right now?
Well, right now, there is an African Union force called AMISOM operating in Mogadishu. Its mandate at the moment is actually providing security for the so-called transitional federal institutions, which includes the transitional federal government and the transitional federal parliament. At the moment, they are focusing exclusively on combating al-Shabaab in Mogadishu and essentially exerting control over the entire city on behalf of the transitional federal government. My understanding is that in that context, they are certainly helping providing security to the refugee camps in areas controlled by the transitional federal government of Somalia. When it comes to providing security to bring food to other areas, I don't think we're really at that point yet. No one is trying to bring food into Shabaab controlled areas and is being blocked from doing so at the moment. I think there's two issues. One is that a number of agencies are trying to negotiate with both al-Shabaab and local authorities to ensure that they would have safe access. And I think there is also a concern that if those agencies were to travel with AMISOM protection, that may actually bring them into the greater conflict between al-Shabaab and the transitional federal government and AMISOM. So I would argue that the first thing that people should try, or these agencies should try, is to see if whether they can do this without protection from AMISOM. And so they don't become part of the greater military struggle over control in this region.
Mm-hmm. Samhar, which aid agency do you think is doing the most right now? And we'll keep talking about this in our next segment.
Well, I mean, it's hard to pick just one. There's a number of local, regional, international organizations working in the region to respond to the drought, to respond to the famine, to the outgrowth of influx of people and of Somalis in Kenya and Ethiopia. At Oxfam, we work with a variety of partners, and we encourage people to donate anything they can to their organization of choice. You can go to oxfamamerica.org and donate through there, but you can also visit websites of the respective agencies and see what agencies they're working with on the ground.
Okay, and we'll be coming back to that next. We want to thank Sinead Murray with the International Rescue Committee. She was actually with us from the refugee camps in Dadaab. Thank you. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the food crisis in East Africa this hour with Samhar Araya, the Horn of Africa Regional Policy Advisor for Oxfam America, and E.J. Hogendorn, Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. Samhar, we were talking about trying to follow the money, if you will, when someone contributes. How does the aid, how does it get there? What are the access routes? Could you walk us through?
Yeah, when a person goes on their website and presses click, you always wonder what happens to that money and how does it transfer on the ground. there are scores of organizations who have had best practices for years, who when they receive the public support, it translates into a series of different programs based on the needs on the ground. We have many organizations have offices and locations in the region, and together they develop programming with the communities. So in our case, we have constant assessments with the communities and organizations to see the needs, whether it's clean water or sanitation or livelihoods. And that money, as an aid community, is assessed with other agencies, whether it's the UN or the donor countries. And together as an international community, we work to discuss the details of how that money is used for the programming to respond to the needs. So what we've been doing is our staff have been going up in Kenya to northern Kenya to parts of beyond Dadaab in Wajir and other areas to assess the needs and begin to develop the type of programming that each community needs.
Mm-hmm.
And when we've received the funding, it allows us to scale up immediately and as quickly as possible. And together, NGOs have been working together to put a message out and give the most accurate picture. And then, of course, we have this sort of monitoring and reporting and accountability that we know everyone needs to see. So we expect this crisis to worsen before it gets better. And what our concerns are is the rains won't even come until October. And we're estimating that we'll need an additional $300 million between now to October just to respond to what will be the even drier parts of the year right before the rains come in October.
Mm-hmm.
And so our staff have been in the field running and scaling up massively.
$300 million now, and I believe that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon talked about $1.6 billion overall to address the situation not only in two sectors of Somalia but throughout the region. EJ, how come when we are alerted to crisis in a place like, well, for example, I can think about Haiti or Japan, there is a sort of flood of what we can do, and somehow, do you think, as Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group, you were in Nairobi this past May, is Africa in a different category in terms of our response gene, if you will?
No, I don't think so. I think that, I mean, rightly we spoke about the fact that there is there is fatigue with Somalia to a large degree because Somalia has been a failed state for more than 20 years. But I think that when people are made aware of the fact that the situation is so desperate, they do respond. The problem really is getting people to pay attention, and what happens is that unless you see, you know, the horrific images that we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks, people really don't sense that the situation is as desperate as it is, and that's in large part because there just isn't access and there isn't a lot of reporting about this situation. I think, you know, unfortunately, you as a journalist know that the media has been closing foreign outposts for quite some time now, and the news trickling out of Africa is indeed a trickle, and people really aren't aware of what people are facing on a day-to-day basis in much of sub-Saharan Africa, and certainly not in the Horn.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, I think that last year, some of the Shabab-controlled territory, people there, insurgents there, said there is no crisis. And so that doesn't help either. But as we now know, there certainly is. Let's go to a call. Mabi is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Mabi. You're on Point.
Yes, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I suggest that Somali, the failed state, now there is a weak government debated in Mogadishu, and the people are starving. I think what we need in Somalia right now is military or any capable force, those can make sure the logistic and supply to the humanitarian agencies, which they can distribute. I was part of United Nations mission in Somalia. I work in Somalia, part of Mogadishu and southern Baidawa and lower Shabelle. So the people are starving. The people coming to Mogadishu, they are coming to neighboring countries. They are not tourism. They are not for tourism there. They are hungry, they die their people, and they are starving. So what we need in Somalia is a strong military command. We do make sure that humanitarian agencies, their lives and to safeguard logistics and supply. That's my point.
Thank you. Do you have anybody you know through the Somali expatriate community who has lost land or loss of life in the family or who is in some way going through this?
What I think is that Somalia has a very weak government. So what we need this time is an action like 1992. We cannot wait till our people are, what you call, dying for hunger. The people are dying for flies.
Mm-hmm. You're referring to the earlier famine in 1992 when you were there.
Yeah, people in Mogadishu, in Baidaba, the people, every single day when you go to the hospital, I was with Jeffrey this morning for, you know, the New York Bureau in Nairobi.
Mm-hmm, who
the
we talked to.
People are starving at flights every single day. We bury 100 people, especially women and children. So what we need, action from the international community.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, there you have it, E.J. Hogendoorn and Samhar. We hear what I think sounds like a really a desperate plea for intervention. What do you think about more soldiers, E.J.? Is that likely?
Well, let me actually also address one point that was raised just mm-hmm. a minute ago, which is the diaspora and its role in Somalia. I think one thing that needs to be recognized is that the Somali diaspora is very large and that they actually provide an enormously important social safety net towards their kin in Somalia in the guise that they send huge numbers of money or amounts of money to Somalia, and that is, for many people, that is the only way that they can survive. And so that's a very important function that the diaspora plays. And, of course, that is also made more difficult by the fact that Western governments are concerned that those donations may end up with al-Shabaab. But we have to recognize that the Somali diaspora already plays an enormous role in alleviating the suffering of their families in southern Somalia. When it comes to boots on the ground, I think that it becomes a very complicated question. I mean, undoubtedly, everyone is familiar with Black Hawk Down. And I think that, and of course, this is when U.S. Special Forces helicopters were shot down over Mogadishu during the U.S. intervention in Somalia in the early 1990s. And I think that the United States and most Western governments would be extremely reticent to revisit such a mission.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that AMISOM, while it certainly has a very robust presence in Mogadishu, is not really right now in a position to provide the type of security that would be necessary to basically occupy all of southern Somalia. And it risks really reigniting a backlash where Somalis traditionally have been very hostile to neighboring countries, and it allows al-Shabaab to portray those missions as occupations rather than as humanitarian in nature. Lastly, what I would argue is that the non-military route really hasn't been tried yet. I mean, we're all struggling or we're all talking about the need to bring in food, but the reality is that people just haven't tried it yet. The World Food Program announced just a couple of days ago that they're ready to start operating in the south again, that they're negotiating with al-Shabaab. There's lots of other organizations that are doing the same. And the one other thing that I would like to stress on this show is that al-Shabaab is not a monolithic organization, and this is reflected by the fact that you see these very different statements coming from different parts of the organization. Al-Shabaab actually, or at least part of al-Shabaab, announced at the beginning of the month that they wanted to lift all these restrictions on aid organizations and welcomed humanitarian assistance. And then what happened was a more hard line, a more radical element said, no, those restrictions haven't been lifted. And so I think, again, this is also an opportunity for the international community to start engaging with more pragmatic elements within al-Shabaab and say, look, you know, we want to work with you if you renounce terrorism, if you can ensure the safety of our humanitarian agencies, and then we will provide that aid where it's necessary, right in those famine areas.
Right. Samhar, who do you see taking the lead right now since you were just in Kenya for a couple of months? What is the American position there as you saw it?
Well, I mean, the United States is one of the is the lead donor on the drought assistance for the region. You know, in the past year, we've given the United States, we've seen about $446 million going to the drought, and most recently there was an additional $46 million to respond to the emergency in Somalia, the famine and the immediate needs. And so it's extremely commendable that the United States stepped out early when we saw the warning signs of the drought months before. But it, at this particular time, because of the scale of the famine, we need to see an increase in the funding, but also an ability to provide the assistance. And I think that's the interesting point here is that, you know, when you get the assistance, it's also about being able to deliver it. There are people on the ground, there are humanitarian groups that are ready to go in, and they're ready to help the those communities most in need. There's also an ability for local and regional actors to work that we would like to support. And so what we do from here and what the donor countries and what the average American can do is simply providing that sort of assistance. And what's interesting is, to go back to also build on EJ's point, is I'm a Minneapolis native, so I grew up in a community rich with Horn diaspora. And I know the region as well, having just been there. And what I saw in Kenya and what I've seen in throughout the region is a level of resilience, dedication, and ownership to solve the problems themselves. And so what the international community's role could be in this instance is to support that and is to work in partnership with them. And already diaspora communities in the Twin Cities are organizing here in Washington. We're seeing an outpouring of the desire to support and help. And from an Oxfam perspective on the ground, it's incredibly inspiring to watch Somali aid workers putting their lives on the line for years. This isn't new to them. There's a capacity and an ability to cope. And so when we talk about the famine, we need to understand that this is the worst we've seen it. This is the worst drought we've seen in 50 years. But there are ways to reach the people, and there are ways to save lives.
Mm-hmm. I think what I hear you saying is let's think about some of the individuals who are helping, because it's very easy for such individuals to get lost. Let's take another call. We'll go to Nancy, who's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently in Kenya, and while I agree with much of what's being said, I think that what we don't talk about enough is the, particularly in Kenya, is the amazing amount of corruption. And I'd have to say that until Kenya is really willing to deal with that, so much of the aid that we send to Kenya is really not, is sent through a very corrupt bureaucracy. And I think that that's something that we have to be honest about. And I think that we have to hold the governments more accountable for the way that they use the aid money and, you know, set up structures that really try to minimize that.
All right. Thank you. Let's put that to you, Samhar. You have Oxfam's been there for 20 to 30 years. You have worked with Nelson Mandela's group, the Elders. Is the money going to the organizations, or is it routed through Kenyan officials?
Well, I mean, I think what we really have to focus on right now is the overcrowding and immense need that we're seeing in Kenya. In Dadaab, which is supposed to only hold, I say only because of how massive the scale is, 90,000 people, and we're at 340,000. Dadaab, there's another camp that is supposed to be opened, and instead of being opened to respond to the needs, as the government of Kenya had pledged, we still are waiting for it to open. And we're very concerned about the ability to provide services to those that have trekked for 3 to 4 weeks, risking their lives and many dying in the process, to arrive to a camp and not being able to get the water to save them or the nutritional assistance that they need. So our concern is the ability of regional actors to work together to respond to this need and allow people to come in and help prevent further death and misery. And so in Kenya, there is a camp called IFO 2, which is prepared, which is ready, more or less to be opened. And we in the humanitarian aid community, are waiting for that camp to be opened. And I think the international community is working. We would plea to the government of Kenya to open that as quickly as possible.
How many people do you think it will be able to hold?
It's not expected to hold as many as Dadaab. We don't want the camps to be the answer. We have to look at the root causes of what are driving people out, and we have to begin providing assistance so that people can live and survive on their own. We need to invest in agricultural development, long-term economic planning. We need to provide assistance that will allow communities and countries to rebuild themselves. From an African context, as a member of the African diaspora, I think there are strong initiatives coming out of the continent to respond to needs on the ground. But the African Union recently pledged $300,000. The African Development Bank recently pledged $507,000, which is commendable, but it's not enough. And so we would call on regional organizations, ECOWAS, AU, and other actors to actually engage more directly in the region for that humanitarian appeal.
Yeah. Well, thank you both very, very much for putting faces and strategies together as we look at the crisis of famine in Ethiopia. The UN will declare, in Somalia. UN will declare the entire region in Somalia a famine zone by the 1st of August. Samhar Raya is with Oxfam America, the Horn of Africa Regional Policy Director, and E.J. Hogendorn is Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. Thank you both very, very much. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. If you want to donate to help the victims of the food crisis and the famine in Somalia, you can find links to both Oxfam and the IRC on our website. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.